Good evening, everyone. Good evening. Once again, you've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters, and Paradigm Shifters are beings, wonderful beings, who are making a difference in the collective of our species. I say making a difference because most of them, including tonight's guest, are really influencing how we think as a intellectual community. And tonight, Dave DeLuca is going to bring us a lot of information and wisdom that comes from ancient, what is it, Hinduism? Welcome, first of all, Dave, and then we'll pick your brains here.
Welcome. Thank you, Veronica, for having me.
Yes, I know that you're quite a well-known teacher of the ancient, Vedic or Vedanta scriptures?
Vedanta.
I don't know what the difference between Vedic and Vedanta is, but your latest book is Sacred Jewels of Yoga, and I'd love to talk to you about what is the philosophical and historical base to yoga. What's the spiritual essence of it? And I think that's your shtick, right?
Yes. It's
that's
my shtick.
It's a cheeky way to put something so profound, isn't it?
Let's say it's my great love. It's from the moment that my eyes came across the scriptural treasures of ancient India, the Vedanta yoga scriptures. It was like they took me and grabbed me and said, "You're with us now."
Where did you start? What were you doing when you not stumbled over it? I'm sure you were seeking, but where were you in your life when you found this Vedanta?
Well, Veronica, before I answer that, if I could just address the Vedanta so that we know what we're talking about.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, the Vedanta is two words, Veda and Anta. It literally means the culmination or the end of the wisdom or the truth or the knowings, which is the Vedas. The Vedas are the oldest religious scriptures on the planet. They are arguably the oldest book on the planet, extant book on the planet. It's four books. Mm-hmm. And the last portion of the Vedas are the Upanishads. Maybe you've heard of them.
I sure have, and that's the last section of the Veda, huh?
That's correct, mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons it's called a culmination, the Vedanta, the Upanishads being the culmination. But another reason is that it is the highest form of philosophy from the Vedas, dealing with humanity's first affirmations of the oneness of existence, mm-hmm. of the divinity of the soul, of reincarnation, of yoga, of karma, of meditation, of so many of the things that people in the alternate or spiritual world in America love, but don't know come from one particular source. And the Upanishads and the Vedas are called Shruti, meaning heard. Not developed by an author, but heard from God. So they hold the highest level of authority in the scriptural treasures of India. And in fact, every scripture that comes from that time on that is considered authoritative in any way must comport with the authority of the Upanishads. But because you've read some of them, you know that the Upanishads are static revelations from seers, not trying to codify wisdom, mm-hmm. but expressing it as if they have just heard it. Mm-hmm. And because of that, there's a great breadth of wisdom, ways to see what they're saying, and from there, how to develop systems to lead people to greater truth, which it can all be boiled down to. You ask the question, what is the philosophy about? What is yoga? Mm-hmm. Yoga at the highest level, its highest definition, is the union between the individual soul and the supreme soul.
Oh, okay.
And the secondary meaning is the paths or the disciplines or the practices that lead to that union. And that is what the whole thing about these, the scriptures are about reaching the self or Brahman, these different words to denote or connote the highest principle Sat-Chit-Ananda, infinite existence, infinite consciousness, infinite bliss. That is the one infinite existence. Mm-hmm. And that becomes the overriding goal within, whether it's the Upanishads or the Bhagavad Gita or Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. It is pretty much all summed up from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, where it says this, where there is, and I'm quoting from the book, from a passage from the oldest, what is considered to be the oldest Upanishad known. And it goes like this: where there is unity, one without a second, that is the world of Brahman.
Hmm.
That is the supreme goal of life, the supreme treasure, the supreme joy. Those who do not seek this supreme goal live on but a fraction of this joy.
Hmm. That's wonderful. Now I'm going to throw it into the third dimension, meaning the self. Okay, the word self, as a lot of us have sought the reality of self, but in this book I'm realizing, or I guess I kind of knew this before, we seek self till we get to know self, to know self at all. I mean, N-O self. Do we, or when we merge with divinity, is that the role?
I'm not sure of the terms and the phraseology that you're coming from. So mm-hmm. Let me just tell you how this is related in the Upanishads.
Okay.
The translations, first of all, Brahman is the word meaning the great expanse mm-hmm. for the oneness. Atman is the Brahman indwelling, meaning the Brahman within the lotus of our heart.
Is it that like the divinity within us all?
It is not like it. It is it.
It is it. All right.
Every teaching you have ever heard about this mm-hmm. has come from and first sourced in the Upanishads. This is what has made the Upanishads such a revelation throughout history. Mm. It is fair to say that the Upanishads had a tremendous impact upon Greece and upon the Sufi movement and upon the Neo-Vedantics in Europe during the 17th and 18th centuries, upon Emerson and Thoreau, because wherever it is read, people with a unitive heart say, yes, yes, I believe that all is one, and I believe that at the very center of my being is not anything less than the blessedness or the divinity. Mm. So, yes. Now, in one of the English translations is self and self. Self with a capital S mm-hmm. denotes the infinite Brahman or the spirit within.
Oh, I see. I see. So I confused you with the way I use the words so generally, right?
Well, self with a capital S connotes the highest within us, and okay. self with a small s connotes the individual or the life of the body, mind, and senses,
okay.
which are pretty much running the show when we're not identified with and the condition of our lives. Hmm. Without knowing this wisdom, is that we think, for example, if I get angry, I think I'm angry.
Mm-hmm.
When, if I am the infinite spirit, is not, because in oneness, who's there to get angry with?
Mm-hmm.
There has to be a false notion of duality for having an object of your anger. And that is part of the spiritual psychology that is so powerfully stated for the first time in the Upanishads. In the Katha Upanishads, it says, and I'm quoting once again from the book, there are two selves, the separate ego and the indivisible Atman.
Hmm.
When one rises above I, me, and mine, the Atman is revealed as one's real self.
Hmm.
That is so simple and yet so powerful. And once we understand this, and throughout the Upanishads and throughout the Vedanta, knowledge is the key. Because once we understand that there are two modes of cognition within us,
mm-hmm.
then we can start really being able to see it easily. Because when we're filled with joy in doing something, there's no nastiness within us. There's no room for it. There's no room for any smallness. Hmm. And conversely, when we're filled with smallness, like anger or jealousy or possessiveness
fear.
Or fear, there's no room for spirit.
Hmm.
And so once we start seeing that there's two modes of cognition, as the Upanishads teach us, now we can start saying no. Because we know that the thing that we used to identify with ourselves, I am angry or I am afraid, let's use fear as an example, mm-hmm. I'm afraid. Well, that can't be of the infinite spirit, because being afraid means there's something other that is the object of our fear. The infinite Atman is the wellspring of all joy. And we can sum up all of religious work as a work towards self-mastery with a small s, learning how to control the senses, the body, and the mind, because either they are using us because they're not who we are, or we are saying no to them, and we are allowing God or spirit or whatever, you know, for your audience, some people within your audience won't like the word God, but mm-hmm. some people will love it. But you could say the higher self, the highest within you, mm-hmm. either it is going to be able to express through you, mm-hmm. or these lesser selves are going to be able to express through you. And that is what the Upanishads call slavery, based on ignorance of who you are, that identification with the lower within us rather than the higher within us.
Hmm.
That was a long explanation.
I loved it.
Okay.
I'm thinking
so self
about,
and self.
I'm thinking about a cheeky line that's used a lot lately. It's not all about you. And it really is all about ourself and how we, mine within the distance between the ego self and the Brahman. Right?
It in life, there is a wonderful passage, and one of the reasons I put this book together was that when I first got involved, I was one of these people that just ate everything up that I could.
Mm-hmm.
I was not intimidated by a 500-page book on it because I loved it.
What were you, a professor? Were you a teacher or what?
I was a seminar leader, mm. and for years I was teaching seminars on a secular level, and then on the Western psychological level, and so I loved learning systems.
Okay.
To help people grow.
Okay.
And so when I came across this system, it basically dwarfed anything I'd ever seen before. I had the same feeling, I believe, that Albert Einstein said his quote is, when I read the Bhagavad Gita and reflect on how God created this universe, everything else seems so superfluous. Or Henry David Thoreau, what did he say? It's very powerful. What was many Westerners who have come across it, he said, I bathe my intellect in the stupendous and cosmological philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita, in comparison with which our modern world and its literature seem puny and trivial. They were among the first, Emerson and Thoreau were among the first to read these scriptures in English when they were first translated. So that's what got me excited about it. But I understand that most Americans don't have that kind of passion or that kind of time. I was a teacher. It's part of my job. I love it, but it was part of my job. So what I wanted to do, and when I started teaching at churches, at New Thought churches and Vedanta temples, I understood the need for people to be able to just get a taste of some of these fantastic scriptural passages. And I believe that anyone with a unitive heart, somebody who has a feeling that there's truth to the idea of oneness,
mm-hmm.
and has some kind of sense of the divinity of their own soul and the souls of others,
mm-hmm.
Once they got a taste of these scriptures, they would want to dig in further. So what I did was I put together what I felt was, and what most people feel, is some of the most beautiful passages from the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, the Narada Sutras, the Bhakti Sutras, and others, plus commentary from Swami Vivekananda and Sri Ramakrishna, into a one-page collection so that people could start somewhere and they could decide for themselves what the definition of yoga is. These days, the definition of yoga in America for a lot of people is 105 degrees and 90 minutes of 26 postures.
And a great body.
And a competitive body.
I know.
Against the teachings, you know, competition is not of the ego. Creativity is, and cooperation is not of the spirit. Excuse me. This is not to belittle any of that. It's
no,
just
I know. I know what you mean. Fashion. It's fashion. It's like we brocade the senses in our society through our writings and behaviors quite often.
That's exactly, you know, what I say is that what we do is individualize and then monetize everything Americans do. And there is now a swinging back. There is now a hunger, my Hatha yoga friends tell me, for people involved who have seen such amazing results in their physicality through yoga and in their greater calmness. For wanting to learn more about the tip of the, for what they know as the tip of the iceberg.
It's wonderful. I want to go back to you saying people don't have time for all the investigation sort of thing. I think that's what you're referring to. But there's a poem here from the Bhagavad Gita called Perfection. And I loved it because it combines things like, by devotion to one's own particular duty, everyone can attain perfection. Let me tell you how. By performing his own work, one worships the Creator who dwells in every creature. Such worship brings that person to fulfillment. There's more to it, but I love that because isn't that the example of how we do our focus and our... Does that make sense to you? How we do it, how we bring ourselves to it, can lead us to that perfection, if that's what the word is.
Well, it is. The Sanskrit is svadharma. You know the word dharma.
Yes.
And this is sva, meaning individual. So it's your individual sacred duty. Dharma has many meanings. It's a rich and deep word. But one of its meanings is sacred duty. Mm. And so the bottom line here is... that we only have two choices in life. That the conditions that are the wisdom that is taught in the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita teach us that either we are slaves to the lower in us who are having their way through us,
mm-hmm.
or we are instruments of the higher. And in this wonderfully laid out God's play called Leela, we have perfect freedom to choose. The problem is that most people don't know about their slavery. There is a wonderful selection from the Katha Upanishad. It's one of the most beloved passages in all of the yoga scriptures. It goes, may I read it?
Yes, please.
Okay. Know the self with a capital S. Know that it is it's a metaphor using a chariot. Know the self with a capital S as Lord of the chariot, the body as the chariot itself, the discriminating intellect as charioteer, and the mind as reins. The senses, say the wise, are the horses. Selfish desires are the roads they travel. Self with a small S, so of the ego.
Mm-hmm.
When the self, with a capital S, is confused with the body, mind, and senses, they point out, he seems to enjoy pleasure and suffer sorrow. When one lacks discrimination and his mind is undisciplined, the senses run hither and thither like wild horses. But they obey the rein like trained horses when one has discrimination and has made his mind one-pointed. Those who lack discrimination, with little control over their thoughts, are far from pure, reach not the pure state of immortality, but wander from death to death. But those who have discrimination, with a still mind and a pure heart, reach journey's end, never to fall into the jaws of death. With a discriminating intellect as charioteer and a trained mind as reins, they attain the supreme goal of life, to be united with the Lord of love. Now, the metaphor here is the body, is the chariot is the body. The spirit, that's the rider, is the owner of the body, And that is the divinity that dwells within each of us. The intellect is weak in its understanding. It doesn't even know there is a passenger or an owner. And therefore, the reins are loose. And the horses are going wherever they want. And our lives are about running after external pleasures and gratifications that can never fully fulfill. The spiritual journey begins when the intellect starts noticing the driver and says, "Who are you?" And the driver says, "I'm the spirit. I'm in the lotus of your heart. I am you." And the driver, the intellect, starts liking what he hears. The tone of the voice, the message, the wisdom, the peace that he feels when tuning in. And the more he tunes in, the more he wants to go where spirit wants the carriage to go. And without that tuning in, the carriage goes where the senses want us to go. And the senses are everything. It's our fears. It's our taste. It's not just appetite for food.
It's ambition.
The senses is everything. It's ambition. It's possessiveness. It's greed. It's fear. It's self-pride. It's look how good I am. And that's one of the ideas of this is that there is nothing that is not God's. For us to take possessorship of anything is almost stealing. In fact, from that point of view, it's considered that. The problem with us taking possessorship is that we take the good with the bad. And now everything that happens is on us. And nothing stays the same. And so no matter how good you are, I saw a biography years ago about Gene Kelly. Remember the dancer?
Oh, yes.
And in his old age, they said he was just miserable. He couldn't get over the fact that he couldn't do it anymore. He was so identified with his greatness. But that is the transient nature of this world of what the Indians call nama-rupa, name and form. Veronica, according to the Upanishads, does not exist. Dave does not exist. It's a temporary manifestation of the one infinite spirit. And the Bhagavad Gita teaches us that there is no, in anything that's impermanent, there's no reality. The only reality is the one infinite spirit. And so when we identify with the spirit within us and we allow it to speak through us, that's when this idea of Svadharma comes in, because I love reading the scriptures, studying the scriptures and teaching the scriptures. Nobody has to make me do it. Why do I love it? Why do I love it so? I love it because at that moment, I'm doing what God wants me to do. Why does the baseball player love playing baseball? Well, he'll tell you, because I just love the game. but the Vedantist would say, no, there's a different meaning for what love is and where it comes from. And that is exemplified in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. I don't know if you read this one. It's on page 5. The wife loves the husband not for the husband's sake, but for the sake of the spirit that is in the husband. The husband loves the wife not for the wife's sake, but for the sake of the spirit that is in the wife. Everything is love not for its own sake, but for the sake of the spirit that lives in it. This spirit has to be realized. Hear about this spirit. Meditate upon him. And when you hear about the spirit, meditate upon the spirit, and finally realize the spirit, you come to understand everything in life. So your intuition about the understanding of the passage that you quoted about living your sacred duty, that is where our true joy is. There is no joy in the finite. There's that, only
that's
joy.
Where we touch our spirit. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, because the joy, the spirit is joy. The term they use is Sat Chit Ananda. Sat means infinite existence. Chit means infinite awareness and or consciousness. And Ananda means infinite joy or bliss. And they say that this is the closest we can get to describing the infinite. From that point of view, you can't say that God of the Vedanta is loving, because that would be to reduce it. God is love. God doesn't exist. God is existence. And when we identify with it, and when we, basically, the whole idea of the religious path is a subtractive one from this point of view that we have an inner divinity, that we are that inner divinity, the divinity itself does not need to grow in us. We need to subtract what hides it from us, what veils its power. So it's like that, and Vivekananda, in a wonderful passage, I don't have it at my fingertip, but it's in the book, says, the spirit is like the sun, and the ego and all of its lower passions and negativity are like clouds. They can block the sun, but they can't.
I read that. That was wonderful, yeah.
Yeah, and that's one of the powers of Vivekananda's commentary. It leads great force. It gives great force to the teachings because he lived it within the scriptures.
So, Dave, tell me how long it took you. Are you able to live it? Are you fully able to do that? How difficult is that? Have you found it a real flow that you can enter at will? Is will the right word?
No, of course not. My strength is my ability to distill what is difficult for people to distill as a teacher. I've been a teacher all my life, from complex systems and make them understandable, and then get on the path. I'm a zealot for this, and what has happened in my life has been miraculous as a result of it.
Oh, really? Can you share some stories? We like miracles.
Well, what I'll say is that I've been saying this for many years. I'm a recovering inconsiderate.
Oh.
And I've been in my life pretty absorbed in me. In my goals and in my and what was important to me. And when I first started seeing these principles, once I started understanding the theory, which is moment to moment pleasure that is passing and that creates a greater addiction to it. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it sure does. Attachment. I would say attachment, right?
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And every time you have the strawberry ice cream, you want more strawberry ice cream.
Yes.
Every time you get angry, what it's called a samskara. It's a tendency.
Right.
It basically, every time you let that tendency run your body, run your senses, run your mind, because let's use your fear. When somebody's in fear, their whole body, and let's say it's not a... a real fear, but it is psychic pain, not based on any imminent danger.
Right.
I mean, that's a different thing. But then what's happening is this samskara of fear has taken the entire body over and ripped you off during that time of your ability to feel and experience the divine presence within you and to allow it to speak fully through you. Which is the greatest joy in the world when that happens. And we feel that whenever we see a movie that unites us, whenever we're in the arms of our beloved, whenever we're with our children, whenever there is joy in our lives, the Upanishads teach us that Brahman is there, that is the spirit. And so once there is that kind of discernment, then you go out, and it's like baseball. You get up at bat. Every interaction with somebody is an at bat. And either you hit a home run or you strike out, but you're not doing it because for yourself. You're not doing anything for yourself with a small s anymore.
So it's back to, it doesn't almost matter which thing we're doing. We're taken out of it being the thing or its attachment.
Well, and that gets into the idea of the four yogas.
Okay.
The four yogas are part of the great Vedanta system. And let me see, I probably will do better in just reading it from the introduction. Actually, I probably wouldn't do better reading it. I'll just tell you. These sages, these unknown sages from the Upanishads, and probably before, determined or figured out somehow that we have four basic faculties through which we can grow. We have the faculty of the intellect. We have the faculty of love. We have the faculty of psychic control. And we have the faculty of work, of physicality. And the four yogas are based on those four faculties. Bhakti yoga is the yoga of love. It is selfless devotion to a divine form, whether it's Christ or Buddha or Lakshmi or whoever. And most religious folks throughout the world are bhakti yogis, even if they're Christian, even if they're Jewish, because they're worshiping a god outside themselves. And the very process of being a bhakti yogi diminishes the impulses for the lower, because the love of the higher is so much more focused and so much more true to the bhakti. So if you're with your beloved, if you're with somebody you love greatly, there's very little that can get in the way of that love while you're feeling it.
That's right.
Because they're lesser loves. Mm-hmm. And so that's the path of love. The path of wisdom is the path of jnana yoga, and that is through the discrimination, using your intellect to discriminate through all of the seeming forms of life and saying, no, that chair is not a chair, that's God in manifestation. It's all the infinite one in manifestation. And every thought and feeling and emotion in my mind that blocks that truth, I reject. That is the most difficult path of all four of them, because it requires this almost superhuman ability to see through illusions that are so powerful. Okay, then comes karma yoga, and that's what we're talking about. That's what we were just talking about that led into these four yogas. Karma yoga is the yoga for the active, and that is selfless service. That is the idea of doing all your work as a sacrifice, meaning spiritually motivated. And one of the great teachings, if not some would argue the greatest teaching of the Bhagavad Gita, is this idea of doing your work with no attachment to the fruits of it or anything. It's just that you are an instrument in God's hands. Do the work. Do not worry about the outcome. Do not go too high with it. Do not go too low with it. Just do the work and give it up to God. Now, you don't have to believe in God to be a karma yogi. You can start by giving it up to the highest within you. In other words, becoming an advocate for, in your work, doing it for the welfare of something higher than yourself. But eventually, all of these paths lead to love, because love is the first seed of the soul. It's the highest form of union that human beings know. Okay, so let me see if I
can... love that first seed of the soul. I love that.
Did you read that in the book?
I did, but you're refreshing me. And this book for everybody at home is called Sacred Jewels of Yoga. It is an easy read, but it's the kind of read that you're going to want to I was going to say digest, but it's more like that. It's more that it permeates something within.
Well, because they're one page passages. The old ways that, and I'm sure they're still being done in India and in tradition, but the old ways of teaching was one passage at a time, where the student would contemplate it, try to affect it into their lives, meditate on it for days at a time. So because each one of these are one-page passages, you can just take a paragraph that strikes you. For example, what we were just talking about. This is the oldest extant statement of the oneness of existence. It's the creation hymn from the Rig Veda. And in the one arose love, the first seed of the soul. The truth of this, the sages found in their hearts. Now, if you to meditate on that, to sit, to kind of envision that in your life, you know, I start with, well, that's true. There's no greater bonding in my life than the love I feel for the people I love and for the things I love. Mm-hmm. That's what unites me. So today I'm going to go out into the world, and I'm going to see if I can experience that with every interaction. Now, once again, it's like getting up to plate. Some you'll remember, some you won't. Mm-hmm. But every day, if you just read one of these and find one that sticks to your heart, and go out and... This is a book designed to be on your bedside, your bedstand, forever if you love the Indian way. If you don't love the Indian way, it may not speak to you, but for those who believe, once again, in the oneness of existence, the divinity of the soul. These are the source scriptures. And because we're not going to be able to cover all of this in our interview today, I would just like to ask the listeners who are interested in this I invite you to go to davedeluca.com. That's DAVEDELUCA.com. I've posted a bunch of passages from the book so that you can get a taste for it and see if it's something that your soul wants. And if it does, go ahead and purchase the book. You won't be disappointed. If your soul says yes, then you will not be disappointed with it. The majority of the book is passages from the sacred scriptures without any kind of interference by my commentary. I have an introduction where I go over the basics, which people have said they found very, very worthwhile.
And I love the presentation because it's easy to get an eyeful. And I want to put this little eyeful in front of you right now. Can I do that?
Of course.
This is in one called, Oh, Knower of Truth.
And it's, what page is it on?
It's on page 73.
Okay.
And the first two lines, it's just simply two lines that people at home might appreciate. I'm sitting and thinking about it over the last few days. The knower of truth is never miserable in this world, for the whole universe is filled by himself alone. That's pretty powerful.
It is, and it's basically saying when we are connected to the infinite one, that is the divinity of our soul, who is there to get angry with? Who is there to be fooled by? Who is there to be nervous about or fearful of?
And that's ultimately what oneness is all about, isn't it?
Yes, well, oneness is the for those of us, I'm hesitant because Vedanta has room for what's called oneness, mm-hmm. for qualified duality, and for duality as well. In other words, there are Vedantists who believe in oneness, like Ramakrishna was a great example of this. This was one of the greatest examples of a saint who was able to be in this samadhi, this state of oneness, for longer periods of time than anybody on record. But as soon as he would come out of it, he would become a child devoted to the worship of the mother.
Oh.
And he said, so long as there is a slight whiff of ego, and God wants us to have ego, then see yourself as a servant or an instrument or a child or a lover of God. He said, even the greatest proponents of oneness sometimes want to taste the sugar. They don't want to be the sugar.
Hmm.
How's that for sweet?
I like that.
That's in the book as well. That's that wonderful blend of saying, from the Vedantic point of view, or let's say from the Vedic point of view, God assumes forms for the welfare of the devotee.
Hmm.
So those who love Jesus with all their heart, mind, and soul, mm-hmm. from a Vedantic point of view, they have a relationship with Jesus. It's real.
Hmm.
Because God wants to be whatever we want him or her to be in order for us to reach. Now, one of the miracles in my life, my mom in 2002, started with Alzheimer's, dementia.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that what would have happened in this path would have been so different if I hadn't had this understanding and made the progress that I had made. So the answer to your old question is am I realized or any of that? The answer is no. but have I come a tremendous way based? And that's the great promise. The yogis for thousands of years have anonymously added their wisdom to this largest corpus of oneness wisdom, mm-hmm. and practices for attaining oneness. And they've all said the same thing. Just you don't have to create a new path. Just find the path that works for you. If you're an active guy, start with karma yoga. For me, as a karma yogi, I'm a little bit of everything because my teachers were a lot of everything, Vivekananda and Ramakrishna. But I know I get up and I do my work, and I am doing it free of fear from what it's going to be. Mm. If I can feel the prompting, everything good that happens to me, I feel is the prompting of the Spirit handing me what I need to fulfill its purpose through me.
Mm-hmm.
And everything bad that happens in my life is me saying yes to some sensory addiction within me that has its way with me that I wasn't able to overcome. And as I continue to get up and fight, I become winning more than I lose.
Mm.
And that's what will happen to anybody that says, number one, the Upanishads say it takes three things to really proceed fully. Number one, you have to hear about it. You have to hear the wisdom in order for you to start the process. So number one, you hear about it. And that can be in a book. Mm-hmm. That can be with a religious teacher. That can be on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
Number two is reason on it. Apply your reason to it. And if it passes reason, move on to number three. And if it doesn't pass reason, let go of it. It may be true. But at that point in your journey, it's not important because it hasn't passed your reason test.
Okay.
And if it passes reason, then the next one is to meditate on it, which is not simply closing your eyes and being with it, although that's part of it. It is making it part, a contemplation that's in your life as much time of the day as you can until it permeates your very being and becomes part of how you see life effortlessly rather than something you have to try to struggle to remember.
So what about the exercises of yoga and so on? They're not irrelevant, but they are just one little aspect of it?
The postures?
Hatha, the postures, yes.
Hatha is a, let's put it into perspective. The Hatha scripture, the Pradipika, I believe is 15th century AD.
Oh.
It goes back to a source that's around 11th century AD. Patanjali's Yoga Sutras goes back to around the time of Christ. They give a window between 200 AD and 200 BC. The Bhagavad Gita is somewhere pre-Buddhistic, so it's 6th or 7th century BC.
Mm-hmm.
And the Upanishads, with the new findings they're finding, archaeological findings that are dating the Vedas way before they have been dated up until presently, are probably somewhere between 1500 BC and 2000 BC, safely around 1500 BC for the oldest, and many of the ones that I quoted were the oldest.
Well, that's
so
pretty
we're talking a range of around 2,000 to 3,000 years difference between the beginning of Hatha Yoga, although the idea of Hatha, of asana, is in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. It's phase three of the Ashtanga, the eight limbs of it. And in the original Patanjali Yoga Sutra, it is just about asana in the singular. It's about a posture. Put your body in a place where you can just forget about your body so you can get on to the business of meditation.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's convenient. Now, there's something we haven't quite covered, which is the four yogas. You said intellect. And then you didn't...
I get so carried away.
That's okay.
I love it.
But I could talk to you for days. But I just want to ask this one thing. The psychic control, what is that?
Let me just add one other thing for my Hatha Yoga friends.
Please.
There is no doubt that Hatha Yoga has health benefits that are amazing, and they are part and parcel of the whole. India doesn't throw out bones; it doesn't throw out anything. It uses everything. When Buddhism finally died in India, they made Buddha a god. You know? So Hatha Yoga has a tremendous force for good, and it is now. But in the hands of some people, it has been turned into a competitive sport. And in America, you know, individualize and monetize, it has lost its connection to the whole meaning of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, which it's linked to, which is the attainment of the Atman, which is that fourth yoga, which is the psychic control. The Bible of Raja Yoga is Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. And psychic control means just that. It means it is for the contemplative in nature. who likes the idea of sitting quietly and seeing what's beneath the current of what the Indians call the vrittis, the mind stuff, the churnings of the mind.
Well, you know, something I want to just throw this in, Dave, is in a state of duress some time ago, my initiation period, I started doing yoga out of a book meticulously for 3 hours a day, and my confusion with who I was snapped open and my visions opened, and I began to access my intuitive self, which I should have done because I think it's natural to me, but it was yoga, hatha yoga, out of an Iyengar book, actually, that did that for me.
Well, the point here is that you can go to a, you can go to a ballet dance class with a teacher who is a spiritualized teacher, and it be a spiritual experience. And you can go to a hatha yoga class to a teacher that has no real interest in spirituality at all.
That's right.
But those teachers, Inger and people like those, they are very serious about the health benefits that are full body, mind, and spirit. So I hope nobody is hearing me in any way denigrating that. I think that millions of people in America will come to a greater understanding of yoga through hatha yoga, and maybe wouldn't be able to do it any other way.
Yeah, and there's an old line that said people do the right things for the wrong reasons sometimes too. So even though it's in fashion, it still can lead you to a certain realization, can't it?
Well, the whole thing about the universality of the Hindu way, really the Vedantic way, comes from the Rig Veda, Ikam Satvi Prabhuta Vedanti. Truth is one. The sages call it by different names.
Uh-huh.
That allows for every possible system to be recognized. And if it raises your awareness of spirit, if it makes you more united with the highest within you, then it is a yoga, and it is a powerful yoga in your life. Whether it's hatha, whether it's kundalini, whether it's bhakti, whether it's jnana, whether it's a combination of all of it, the whole purpose is to rise towards union with the highest within you, because that's what the sages are unanimous with. That is where the joy is, and that is the whole purpose of life. The whole purpose of life, all of nature, all of the experiences we go through, is to bring spirit back to spirit.
How wonderful. And are you doing your exercises every day? Are you doing your asanas?
No, that is not my temperament. I don't have that kind of drawing to it. And if you don't have that kind of drawing to it, you're not going to do it. My drawing is the Vedanta, is the jnana, and that is the reading of the scriptures. I love that. That's what I read, either the scriptures or commentary on it or greater understandings of it from whatever source I can. And the karma yoga, but some of my friends who are the nuns at the Vedanta Society have told me that I'm a bhakti because of my great love for Swami Vivekananda. So this is my path, and basically what Vedanta allows for is a celebration of all paths, because we know that at the mountaintop is the prize, which is that union, and different sides of the mountain have different terrain, and different people have different temperaments. And if one side of the mountain is like you can only get there by becoming a mountain climber, you know, with the pins in the side of the mountain, then that's what you do. And then the other side, if it's a pastoral walk, then that's what you do.
So the whole flow is really about love, isn't it?
It is about following. Yes, it is. It's about following your love, and if your love is let it lead you, because love is another word for God. God is love. Let it lead you to where it wants to take you, because if you become the intellect that allows spirit to be the driver, your life will become blessed. So long as you continue to allow the horses, the senses, to run the show.
Well, I must
say, that is where pain is.
And this book, Sacred Jewels of Yoga, I found it very loving all the way through. So that to me is what you put, you led us in through the book with that particular thing, love.
Well, I'm a classic devotee filled with love for my teachers and love for the wisdom and a determination to do my part in making that wisdom more accessible to folks who have this kind of a heart. So please, folks, if you're interested, check out the website at
I was just going to say that. If you hadn't, this is great.
I told Veronica earlier, I keep forgetting. So now I'm swinging the other side of the pendulum. www.davedeluca.com. Check it out. And if you want to become part of the mailing list, where I'll be sending out articles and things like that, become part of the Vedanta community there, please do.
And do you go out and give talks? Are you giving classes anywhere that we need to know about?
Well, I've been off since November when New World signed me up for this project. I've been immersed in putting the book together, so I haven't been. I'm starting again in September. I'll be at the Vedanta Temple in Hollywood. I don't know the exact date, but it'll be on the website.
That's great. Well, this is so exciting.
Yeah, once the wave of radio interviews stop, then I'll probably start getting back on teaching again. I look forward to it.
You know what's interesting about radio, especially global radio, which is what I love to call this that we're doing, is it does, you talked about waves, it does send waves of that love and that expression of a deep commitment out there, doesn't it?
You know, I'm new. You know more than I do about the range of what radio does, and I'm hoping that it is a platform by which this book can. I'm a caretaker of the book. I don't feel I had anything to do with it, and that's one of the great joys of Karma Yoga is this was what I was supposed to do. I went and did it. I feel I think it's a beautiful book with beautiful passages, but I can't say any of the promptings had anything to do with Dave. And that's a great, I'll tell you what, that is a great blessing, having come from years and years and years of everything being about Dave.
I'm glad you brought it around to that. But this is certainly a book that's touched me deeply, so you've brought the Vedanta into my you've touched my heart with it, and I'm going to keep studying it is what I'm going to do, so that works
well. And keep me posted. And is there a way, do you have write-ins or ways that people can they can either reach me with their feedback from how they felt about the interview, or they can do
sure.
that through you.
I always remind people that if you want to give me any feedback on this guest or suggestions of other guests, email me veronica@veronicaentwistle.com, or you can access Dave DeLuca on his website, www.davedeluca.com. And it's spelt like it sounds, isn't it? DELUCA?
Yep, one of each. And no double L's, no double C's.
Nothing too fancy. Pretty straight up spirit. The spirit flow in your name. But yeah, we often get some feedback. Sometimes it takes a while, and a lot of people listen to the archives, so that might take a wee while. But I know people are going to love this book.
Well, it can't hurt you to own it. And like I said, my mission from day one has been to continue Swami Vivekananda's mission of bringing this wisdom to the West and letting people make up their own choices about how and what it will do for them in their lives.
Well, thank you so much, David. And thank you for being a guest on my show, Paradigm Shifters. And I know that this kind of writing, this is really bringing very ancient wisdom right up to spark people's consciousness. I'm so pleased, and that is paradigm shifting. So thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, Veronica. Thank you so much for having me. God bless you.
God bless you, and good night.